This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On Tuesday, voters in five states got to decide whether or not to make recreational marijuana legal according to state laws. Arizona voters rejected the measure in their state, but citizens in California, Nevada, Massachusetts, and Maine all approved their measures, though the Maine vote may be subject to a recount. The West Coast approvals means there's now a solid block of states on the left coast that all allow for recreational weed. Oregon, Colorado, and Washington have already gone legal. But Massachusetts and Maine are the first states in New England to do so, and that could have an impact on other regional states, like Vermont, that have wrestled with the idea of legalizing marijuana. Today on the show, we're going to get the details on what these two states have approved, and we'll think about how that could affect Vermont's decision-making process come January. If you have questions about the laws in Maine and Massachusetts, or if you want to share your thoughts on the results, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Coming up later in the show, we'll hear from activists in Vermont on both sides of the issue, and we'll get an explainer from a reporter in Maine. But first today, I'm joined by a reporter who can help us understand the new Massachusetts law. Martha Biebinger is a reporter for the public radio station WBUR in Boston. Martha, thank you so much for being here.
So happy to be with you, Jane.
Can you just tick off a couple of points in the new Massachusetts law, what it actually will now allow?
Starting December 15th, it will allow homegrown marijuana. That's six plants per person, but a limit of 12 per household. Possession will no longer carry a fine up to 1 ounce. You'll also be able to gift marijuana up to 1 ounce. Then after December 15th, sometime in the next calendar year, the state is supposed to establish a cannabis control commission. And that will really be the group that regulates the start of a recreational marijuana industry in Massachusetts. It will determine how many stores, where. It will regulate the production and cultivation of marijuana. It will regulate the taxation of the product. But there are some potential intervening factors. Can I jump in on those?
Yeah, please do, yeah.
So the legislature here had looked at this question of legal marijuana for recreational use a number of times, but always declined to really weigh in. So now that it's passed, though, several top leaders, including the governor, think that some changes in the ballot question voters passed last week will probably need to be made. So they're talking about a higher effective tax rate. They're talking about some more specific guidelines. The act is fairly quiet on the whole question of driving under the influence of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And they want something really specific there. And they also want some tighter controls on the types of products that stores would be allowed to sell, including the edibles.
Yeah. So you mentioned the governor. He was opposed to this. The mayor of Boston was opposed.
That's
Massachusetts
correct.
Attorney General all opposed the measure.
Yep.
Voters, though, passed it about 54% to 46%. So this idea of creating some additional changes through the legislative process, is that likely to get some pushback from voters?
Oh, definitely. It will get pushback, and it'll get pushback in particular because the voters here passed a medical marijuana law in 2012, and the first dispensary here did not open. It was supposed to have opened a year later, and the first dispensary did not actually open until June of 2015. So there is a lot of frustration on the part of very vocal supporters of marijuana use and some just general cynicism on the part of other voters that the leaders aren't really taking the will of the people to heart here. So I think there would be, this is just speculation, but my sense is that even when talking to the supporters, they're willing to talk about some changes and some adjustments, but any significant delays would get a lot of pushback.
Although even in the ballot measure, I mean, it was understood that retail sales won't be allowed until 2018, right? That there would need to be this Cannabis Control Commission to create
mm-hmm.
rules
That's
around
right.
licensing and regulation.
That's right. So that it says that the act passed by voters says that that stores could open on January 1st of 2018 it takes into account that delay that we saw here with the rollout of the dispensaries for medical marijuana. And it says that if the commission is not ready to start licensing independent stores, that existing dispensaries, those that are already selling marijuana for medical purposes, could also begin selling for recreational use on that day.
And as for the taxes, as I understand it, according to the ballot measure, marijuana will have a tax of 3.75%, and that's in addition to the already existing sales tax. And can municipalities add their own tax to that if they wanted to?
2%.
2%. Yeah. So
the
you
total
could
effective rate would be about 12. Yeah.
Okay. So you might be buying marijuana in Woburn that's more expensive than marijuana in Worcester.
Not likely. If I would be, I think it'd be very unlikely that both Woburn and Worcester would not implement the 2%.
So they'll both be charging you the extra 2%, probably.
Right.
So it doesn't seem, though, that until retail shops open in 2018 or later, the state will be seeing much of a financial boost from legalization, because right now people will be allowed to grow their own and to gift some, but there's no real market for legal sales of recreational marijuana. Once it does become a position where there are retail shops and there is that tax revenue coming in, is that money earmarked for something specific, or does it just go to the general fund for the state?
Well, the sales tax, 6.25, does go to the general fund. The 3.75% excise tax goes to the running of this new industry and marketplace. So the Cannabis Control Commission would spend that, and then anything in excess they would contribute to the general fund. And the 2% local tax would be distributed proportionally. So, for instance, whatever percentage of sales came from Woburn or Worcester, they would get their share of that 2%. But can I just say one thing about your comment on the taxation of the homegrown? So our state treasurer, Deb Goldberg, has said that she doesn't like that idea, that there will be essentially a sort of a marketplace that's off the books, potentially from the growing and perhaps gifting or selling of homegrown marijuana. And she wants the homegrown use to either be banned or rolled into somehow to the taxation. So that's just another point of tension. I don't know whether her ideas will go anywhere or not, but it gives you a sense of the many layers of conversation that are happening right now.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see how they do that, because, you know, these days, if you buy seeds for your garden for whatever legal plant you're growing, you presumably, you know, pay whatever taxes you need to pay on those seeds, but you don't then pay on the finished tomatoes that you're eating or the tomatoes that you're giving to your neighbor. You're not then expected to go in and pay some exchange tax on them. So, but that's seems to be where the tension lies, how you would sort of regulate that homegrown industry. I mean, similar with homegrown beer, too.
Yeah, right. So that's one layer of tension. Another layer of tension is that the marijuana you buy, if you possess a medical marijuana card, is not taxed. So it's interesting to think about a dispensary that would be selling some marijuana as a medical product and some not. And the sales tax would be applied to one point of sale, but the person behind you may not be paying that.
Martha, as you can imagine, this is a hot topic of conversation in Vermont, as I'm sure it has been and will continue to be in Massachusetts. And we're getting notes from all kinds of listeners about this. Fred in Hyde Park says, according to several studies, Vermont has one of the highest per capita uses of illegal marijuana in the country. Now, two of our border states, although technically Maine is not a border state, but a New England state, have legalized. If Vermont does not legalize and regulate, the fact is probably thousands of Vermonters will travel across nearby borders to regularly buy marijuana. At the same time, Vermonters will be paying pot taxes to Maine and Massachusetts instead of Vermont, while the Vermont illegal unregulated black market stays alive and well. Seems like the worst of all worlds, Fred says. Michael says, cannabis is a pretty subjective experience, and while certain strains have some general effect, it's as unique to the individual as is what they consume. There's certainly lesser and more potent strains, and I could understand not allowing above a certain potency for retail. The level of experience that a consumer has also plays in a factor. For example, a first-time smoker versus a 24/7 smoker. Martha, that's probably something the Cannabis Control Board would be charged with looking at if there were to be any potency laws for retail establishments.
Right. So the law as written, the act as written, says that the products will need to list the potency of various cannabinoids, THC, CBD, some others. The legislature wants to extend that to set a limit, at least for some products, on the THC potency that would be allowed. So, you know, that's an issue that's very much up in the air. And if I could go back to, was it Fred the first person?
Yeah, Fred.
Who wrote this? So on his comment on taxes, you know, that I think was a big reason that the question passed here, was a sense that if there is this pretty robust black market, that we should be, the state should be garnering the taxes from that. And the supporters of legal marijuana say that's the reason they kept the effective tax rate fairly low. So that's that 3.75%. They didn't want the legal market to, they didn't want buying weed legally to be a lot more expensive than the black market, because the idea is that you'll try to shift a lot of what was happening under the radar screen, you know, into this taxable marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Although then that goes to Fred's point about, you know, if you can buy it cheaper legally in Massachusetts, it will still be illegal to cross the border with it. But if you're just looking at financial considerations, it may be cheaper to go to Massachusetts than to buy it on the black market in an illegal state.
Well, sure. I mean, you in Vermont may have a whole different read of that argument than lawmakers here on Beacon Hill in Boston would have.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Bristol. Hi, John. Go right ahead. You're on the air. Hi, John. You there?
Yeah, I am. I'm not a smoker, so it doesn't really matter to me. But I'm curious about the issue of homegrown, because if I understand it correctly, the Vermont law that was considered would have disallowed home growing. And if that's the case, it seems kind of crazy, because it seems like that would, like, the people who want to make a business out of it are, you know, are, we're actively opposing the homegrown function. And I think it seems like that's the first order of business, is to make it legal to grow it and use it yourself.
Yeah, John, to your point, both the Maine and the Massachusetts law allow for home growing pretty immediately. And we're going to get into the details of the Maine law coming up as well. But so that it will be legal in both of these state laws. And you're right, the law that never actually made it through in Vermont had gone back and forth about home growing, but had eventually eliminated that from the proposal that was moving forward. Although our new lieutenant governor-elect, David Zuckerman, is a strong proponent of allowing for homegrown marijuana. Our governor-elect, not a proponent of moving forward at all with marijuana legalization right now. So we'll see what happens there. Let's go to Ben calling in from North Hero. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to call in to point out that, well, there's much that could be disputed. There's no doubt that legalization here will increase usage of marijuana. And with that, there'll be an increase in the number of people killed in the highway. This recent incident in which these five kids were killed in Williston, the driver who killed them was heavily under the influence of THC. And this is going to happen over and over again. I just hope that we can stop talking about the failed prohibition. You know, we have a lot of failed prohibitions, like the prohibition against murder. You know, there's a law against it, but it still happens. But it happens much less than it would without this, than it would if we didn't have that law. So I'm hoping that we won't legalize and promote the use of this drug, because it's going to really hurt a lot of people. I'm a retired judge. I've sat on the bench and looked in the faces of people whose family members have been killed by drunk drivers, and it's not worth it.
Ben, thanks for your call. I appreciate hearing from you. And to that question of driving under the influence, other people wondering about it as well. Chris in South Burlington says, I'm curious what kind of safety regulations will apply. For example, if someone is driving while high and gets in an accident, do they automatically lose their driver's license for a period of time? Martha Biebinger, in terms of the Massachusetts law, I mean, this is something that has been a problem for both legal and illegal marijuana usage in every state, the idea of how do you test for it and test for an impaired driver. But what does Massachusetts say on this? You said it's pretty silent.
Well, what it does say is that the laws regarding driving under the influence would apply to, would continue to apply. So, you know, it is illegal in Massachusetts to drive under the influence of alcohol or other drugs. The problem is, how do you detect that?
Mm-hmm.
Because there isn't a simple, not that breathalyzers are foolproof or there are never problems, but there isn't that kind of automatic test that police can use. People are talking about developing something, but it is more complicated because you may know that the body metabolizes marijuana into fat. It's not sort of quite as directly connected to the bloodstream and the effects. While they may not linger, the presence of marijuana may linger in the body longer. So they're talking about tests that are more based on your ability to perform critical thinking or reflex testing, these types of things. There are some chemical tests in the works as well, but there isn't yet anything that at least police here say would be reliable. So the issue that that the judge raises is important. It's one that people are thinking about a lot, but you know, perhaps in a larger context now because it is legal.
This new law in Massachusetts, as you mentioned, which will allow for home growing pretty immediately, goes into effect on December 15th. Are you seeing a flurry of activity just in time for holiday gift giving?
I have not checked the marketplace on that, Jane. I'll have to tell you. I mean, I can certainly tell you that the marketplace for investment in marijuana related products, everything from the hydroponics to the vaporizers to the social media networks on which people trade information and ideas is really flourishing. Maybe not quite. We have some big angel investors in Massachusetts. We don't necessarily have the industry here, but no, I hadn't checked the Christmas shopping.
I'll be curious to see. Martha Biebinger is a reporter for WBUR in Boston. Thank you so much for your time, Martha.
You're welcome.
We're talking today about legalized recreational marijuana. It was passed by voters in two New England states, Massachusetts and Maine. Later, we're going to hear from a reporter in Maine to get the details on that state's new law. And again, you can post your thoughts, your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's now get the take of one activist in support of legalizing marijuana here in Vermont. We're going to hear from an opponent a little later. Matt Simon is New England political director for the Marijuana Policy Project. Hello again, Matt. Nice to talk with you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So what's your reaction to two states in New England, four states around the country, approving recreational marijuana on Tuesday?
Well, I think it's become clear that the walls of prohibition are crumbling. They've been crumbling on the West Coast for a few years, and now it's come to the Northeast. People realize that marijuana is widely available and widely used. They realize prohibition hasn't worked, and they believe we could do better with a sensibly regulated system. Voters have been way ahead of politicians on this issue for some time, and seeing the voters in Massachusetts confirm that last week just, I think, corroborates what we've been saying all along. And I think the legislators in Vermont, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Connecticut are all taking this issue much more seriously than they were just a week ago, and realizing that there's a practical reason that we need to move forward and take this mini billion-dollar market away from people who are committing felonies and put it in the control of legitimate businesses.
But in terms of Vermont, we have a new governor who wants to take the wait-and-see approach. He says we don't need to do it right now. He's not in favor of moving forward with this in this year, in 2017, when the legislature reconvenes. And the legislature wasn't able to make anything stick this past year, even when it did have a supportive governor. So does this change things in any way for Vermont, starting when the legislature reconvenes in January or convenes for the new session?
Well, my sense has been this issue has been evolving very rapidly, even since the end of the session. There's been a study committee meeting. They're actually having their last meeting tomorrow, where they're supposed to agree on some recommendations, hopefully. But the votes of last week, I think, really send this forward. A lot of the discussion in the legislature earlier this year was, yeah, this is a good idea, but, you know, if Vermont is the only state in New England that does this, there was an element of fear of going it alone, and that fear is now gone. So we know that it's coming to Massachusetts. For people who are concerned that there are going to be a lot of negatives associated with it, those negatives are coming south of the border. I happen to not believe that the negatives will be anywhere near what some people believe. But if this is happening across the border, wouldn't Vermont be better off getting some of that tax revenue so that we can train law enforcement, so we can have more money for substance abuse and prevention and the other things that people think are necessary to prepare for the post-prohibition era.
Although I will point out that regardless of what happens in other states, given that marijuana is still federally illegal and that it is currently illegal in Vermont, it won't be legal to spend your money in Massachusetts and then bring that marijuana back across the border. So it would basically be tourism, which doesn't seem like it would be that much extra money going to the other states, Matt Simon, rather than Vermont.
Well, I'm not sure that reality is necessarily reflective of what the laws and policies are. It would be legal for Vermonters to go to Massachusetts and buy an ounce of marijuana and bring it back. They'd be violating a federal law to cross the border, but we don't have a border checkpoint between Vermont and Massachusetts, so it's not, you know, people will continue to buy marijuana illegally in Vermont, but I think a lot of people are going to be crossing the border once there are retail stores available. People want to be able to buy a product that's been tested, that doesn't have pesticides and heavy metals on it. They want to be able to buy products that are labeled for accurate potency, to know what the THC content is and what the other cannabinoid contents are. And the illicit market's just probably not ever going to be able to provide that service. And once people get in the habit of going to a store that's the equivalent of a liquor store and buying regulated products, it's kind of hard to go back to meeting somebody in an alley and buying some uncertain green plant substance.
Matt Simon is New England Political Director for the Marijuana Policy Project. Matt, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We are talking about legalized recreational marijuana today after it passed in two states in our region. Hearing from many of you, a listener posting as poor in a rural area says, I am so upset with our state politicians. They dropped the ball last session. I can only guess that they do not really understand how much money the growing and exporting of marijuana benefited our state's rural economy. It's all been lost over the past 5 years with the market being flooded with grass from out west. So many of my neighbors have pretty much lost their jobs. Now a neighboring state like Massachusetts will be capitalizing on our incompetence and will be sending all of their marijuana up here. Share your thoughts and questions, your reaction. Go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're looking today at the New England states that have now legalized the consumption and sale of recreational marijuana. Call 1-800-639-2211 with your questions and reactions, or post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We just heard from Matt Simon, who's a proponent of legalized marijuana. Margot Austin, a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, feels strongly the other way. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Margot. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So obviously, you are not pleased with the two states that legalized recreational marijuana in our region on Tuesday. Do you think this changes things for Vermont? Matt Simon says he thinks this will move the ball forward. Do you?
Well, Jane, that's a great question, and I just want to say a little bit about my job is. I've worked in schools. I've been lucky enough to work with youth and adolescents for approximately 25 years in the state of Vermont, and I actually grew up in Massachusetts, so I'm originally a Flatlander. And I think what's really, really important for people to understand is this is a hugely, hugely complex issue which cannot be brought down to sound bites. And I know we live in a culture that's very fast-paced, and people want sound bites. But the reality is Vermont took the time because they realized in the legislature how complicated this issue is. Prevention is key to successful delay of drug use to the adult brain. And I have to tell you, from 25 years, Jane, in the field, there is no other drug, in my professional opinion, that is more revered, rationalized, and misunderstood than marijuana. As a matter of fact, in 1997, which is a long time ago, I created a little parody called The Top 10 Excuses I Hear from Marijuana Users. And what you hear about marijuana is it's organic, it's not addictive, and it does not kill you. And that's really outdated information, and the general populace, I think, has really been misserved by that. What we know nowadays about marijuana is that the THC levels have moved from about 1% to 3% to 15% to 25%, and when you add in butane hash oil, you're talking about up to 90%, which with dabs. we can now scan the brain and see impact on functioning. So what I see in the schools is that many youth who are smoking marijuana can't reach their potential.
But they're doing it already, Margo, whether it's legal or illegal, from what you're saying and from what we're seeing in the statistics. So legalizing marijuana, in your view, does what?
That's a great question. So we have about 35% of teens, and a lot of people, this is another myth, everyone's doing it, and that's actually not accurate. We have about 35% of teens, and you're right, Vermont ranks incredibly high nationwide, and so that's why I'm even more passionate about we need to do a broad-based, very deliberate, dedicated prevention effort. We've done it with tobacco, but until you put that in place, we're not going to actually make inroads on perception of harm. So I think that Vermont has amazing potential right now to put that in place, and I'm very proud that Dr. Chen has actually just spoken about that.
That's Harry Chen, the health commissioner.
Yes, and has said that he wants to put money and realizes that this is a drug that we really have so much, there's so much misinformation. We have it for medical purposes. Does that mean it's bad for me? I mean, there's so much information that people do not know about marijuana. So until we can make the public educated, aware, why would we liberalize a policy?
Well, according to the latest findings from the health department in Colorado, where pot is legal, it suggests that actually marijuana usage among teenagers has stayed relatively flat. Now, there was a bump. The health department in Colorado says that could be a statistical error. It's not statistically significant, that the rise in teen use of marijuana in the latest survey. So it looks like it's stayed flat since marijuana was legalized in Colorado. So why not put into place this education that you're talking about, and then regardless of what happens with legalization?
So a couple things that you should know about Colorado that I understand is that there are many places that opted out, first of all. So the most saturated market is Denver. And in Denver, there are more marijuana shops, and they're often, frankly, in areas that are already really stressed. And there are more marijuana shops than there are McDonald's and Starbucks in Denver. And then there are places with no retail marijuana. So those surveys that you're speaking about actually left out many youth in that survey. If you just look at Denver's numbers, that actually doesn't bear true. So the adolescent use rate has actually gone up in Denver and for much, much lower ages. And when you look at alcohol, I think we have a regulated substance that we've seen for decades. And if that is a successful model, then alcohol should not be the number one most widely used drug by teens. And it is. And it is because it's in everyone's home, and it's commercialized, and it's revered, and it's on television. So we have not showed a successful way to commercialize, frankly, with alcohol at all.
That's Margo Austin. She's a licensed alcohol and drug counselor. And I want to take the time to say thank you for coming on the show, Margo. Appreciate your take.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We're looking today at states in New England that have just voted to legalize recreational marijuana, Maine and Massachusetts. And we're looking at that as well as talking with people on both sides of the issue about what this might mean for Vermont or what they're looking at. Let's get a little bit into the details of what the law says in Maine. Susan Sharon is news director for Maine Public Radio, and she joins us now. Hi, Susan. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first things first, the law passed in Maine, but just barely, according to voter tallies. And I understand there may be a recount. The first steps have been taken. What's the latest on whether or not there's likely to be a recount on this ballot initiative?
Well, right, as you said, the opponents have taken out petitions to try to get 100 signatures that they would need to gather by Wednesday at 5 o'clock, five business days after the vote, to try to get a recount. And right now, the margin that's separating a yes vote from a no vote is under 5,000 votes, about 4,400 votes. So it's a squeaker, and we'll see by Wednesday night at 5 o'clock whether there is a formal request.
So the new law in Maine is similar to what we've been hearing about in Massachusetts. It will be legal to possess and consume marijuana for people over the age of 21. People will be allowed to grow their own marijuana at home. I think it's, 6 immature plants and 12 mature plants per household, or do I have that reversed?
I think it's six. It's six mature plants and 12 immature.
Got it. And in Maine, there's going to be a waiting period as well before any kind of retail stores or what are being called social clubs, kind of like coffee houses in Amsterdam, are allowed to open. And that's to give the legislature time to set up some licensing rules?
That's right. Probably going to take about a year before you would see recreational marijuana sold at a retail store in Maine. And that's because, you know, there's a whole series of rules and regulations that have to be established. Cities and towns are already looking at this and deciding whether or not they want to prohibit them, because that is allowed under the law for a town can decide where they want to put them, if they want to direct a development district for these things, or if they want to just prohibit them altogether. And there will also be rules around seed-to-sale tracking, around packaging, around whether or not certain types of candy are prohibited to try to discourage teenagers and kids from buying them.
So it's unclear at the moment what kinds of edibles might or might not be legal under Maine's law.
Yeah, we heard even from the proponents the other day that, you know, it's not their intent to try to peddle gummy bears and candy that's appealing to kids at these stores. So that is definitely something that's likely to be discussed in the rulemaking process.
When you talk about communities, municipalities being able to reject cannabis stores and social clubs, that's similar to Massachusetts, where towns can limit clubs and then actually put it to a vote within the municipality for voters to say no and completely prohibit recreational marijuana. In Maine, municipalities can reject having these stores and retail locations. They don't have any ability, though, to say that people can't grow their own or consume it in the privacy of their own homes, can they?
That's right. You would still be able to do that. It's really, you know, I really think of this whole passage of question one, the marijuana legalization effort here, as a marketing framework for how it will be sold. We've had medical marijuana has been legal here since voters passed it in 1999, but it wasn't until 2009 that there was an actual framework set up for dispensaries and for the list of conditions that people could buy pot with, medical pot. So it's going to be similar to that, just setting up this framework for how and where it's sold.
I understand that medical marijuana supporters actually have some questions or concerns about this change to legal recreational marijuana. What are they?
Right. Well, so we have had a pretty successful medical marijuana industry here. And, you know, this has been part of rural Maine's underground economy for years. And so in 2009, when the marketing system was set up for medical marijuana, a lot of these people who were growing under the table were able to basically come out of into the light and, you know, set up a little small business. And so there was this interesting dynamic in Maine between medical caregivers and the recreational movement about whether big marijuana would somehow get an advantage here if question one were passed, and put these mom and pop stores, these small businesses, small growers, out of business, kind of Bigfoot them. So there was an interesting dynamic about that, with a split among caregivers, some of whom had concerns about it and who opposed question one for the economic reasons.
Let's go to Dave, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. What are you thinking?
Hi, Jane. So this isn't just a matter of Mass and Maine. Canada is also set to legalize next year. And one very clear impact of legalization is that illegal sellers quickly get displaced by regulated sellers. We've seen that happen in Colorado and elsewhere. But those sellers don't disappear. What they do is they look for new markets instead. I've learned from a 20-year veteran of Border Patrol that the Quebec drug trade is primarily controlled by two violent gangs. So if we don't take control of our nearly $200 million a year underground cannabis market, we in Vermont will become the new market for these displaced sellers.
Dave, thanks for your comments. Thinking there about what this could mean for Vermont, that two New England states have now decided to legalize marijuana. Susan Sharon is with us from Maine Public Radio. Susan, Vermont's new governor, the governor-elect, opposes the idea of moving forward with marijuana legalization, at least for now. That didn't stop measures in Maine and Massachusetts, where both governors also opposed the idea. But in your state and in Massachusetts, the votes were, of course, approved by referendum. Vermont doesn't have that process. Do you think the law in Maine would have passed if it had been up for a vote in the legislature instead of by the will of the people?
Well, in fact, it has. The recreational idea has come before Maine lawmakers in recent years, at least two times before, and the legislature was unwilling to pass the idea of legalizing recreational marijuana outright. And the sponsors of that bill had always said, look, if you don't pass it outright, we're taking it to the people, because they will go for it. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they were correct. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't just our governor who opposes recreational marijuana, but also our attorney general, who raised some concerns kind of in the last couple of weeks before the vote about specific wording that she thought would make this legislation that kids would be able to actually purchase it by the wording of the legislation because of an error, which the proponents said is just not the case. It's pretty clear that they wanted it to be for ages 21 and older.
Well, that law set to go into effect once it's certified, I think 30 days after it's been certified by the governor. We'll wait and see what happens with a potential recount, but it should go into effect just after the new year, if not before. Susan Sharon is news director for Maine Public Radio. Susan, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a new video game at Champlain College aims to tackle a serious subject, sexual harassment and assault. We'll tell you about it next on Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. How colleges and universities deal with sexual assault and harassment on campus has been a matter of controversy lately, with much of the discussion centered on how the institutions address reports of assault after the fact. But at Champlain College in Burlington, there's a new effort aimed at prevention. Students and staff from the college's well-regarded game studio have collaborated on an online game that tackles sexual harassment and assault on campus. Here to talk about the game, called Make a Change, is the professor behind it, Amanda Crispell. She's assistant dean for game development at Champlain. Dean Crispell, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you for having me.
Can you take me just for a minute into the game? What would we experience?
So the game is narrative-based. It's actually a comic book. And in that comic book, you follow the stories of some sophomores that have just returned to campus and some of events that they engage or, you know, experiences they've had during that semester coming back. And the themes that are in the game are sexual harassment, bystander intervention, consent, risky behavior like drinking, and that's all experienced through the story.
And it's in black and white, sort of graphic novel-like?
Yes, it is.
And there are actual things that you do as part of the game, tasks that you have to complete, as well as this narrative story arc?
Right. So what we tried to do is we knew we wanted to have a story that we could talk about, because that's really the point, is to find common ground to discuss these topics. And it's very hard to get a group of college students to sit around and talk about sexual assault. But when you can talk about a story and what characters are doing, it's a much more approachable conversation. So in the game, the overall narrative game, we put what some people call mini games. So these are the interactive components outside of the comic book that are intended to sort of simulate some of the emotional experiences and add content to the game. So, for example, in one game, you're trying to find information, and it's under what we call lock and key. And so you have to decipher this puzzle in order to get to that information. We have another game that is about how we're just constantly under pressure, in some ways under attack from all the digital media that's in the world. And so we have a game where you play, you know, literally like you're under attack from digital media. So each
too many texts.
Yes, too many texts. And you can imagine if you are at the center of a controversy and all of a sudden the whole world is sending you text messages and either accusing you or asking you questions, it can feel like you're under attack.
So you mentioned that it's hard to get a bunch of college students to sit around and talk about sexual assault, and probably hard to get a bunch of anybody to sit around and talk about that.
This is a common conversation that people don't want to have.
Right.
Regardless of who you are, how old you are.
So is having this gaming structure and this ability to have this story through the game actually working at all? It's not mandatory for students to play it at Champlain.
Correct. It's not mandatory. It's a volunteer event. We've run it twice now. We did it last spring semester for the entire college, and then we did it. We ran it again as part of our See, Say, Do campaign, which is about bystander intervention. We ran that this fall with all of the incoming freshmen, and we gave them the option, hey, do you want to come and try this out? So, yeah, it's only voluntary. And I just lost track of your question.
Well, what is the result? I mean, are people talking about it? Do you find it's opening that conversation?
So, I mean, these are things that are hard to put numbers on. You know, I have heard through student life that they have been extremely happy about the kinds of conversations that they've honestly rarely had been able to have before, that we now can have. So that's really important. We have some instances where we've heard that the game itself has influenced whether someone came and maybe reported something through our student conduct. So yes, I think it's a work in progress. We call it a prototype, and hopefully we'll continue to work on it. But yeah, I would say it has had a positive effect.
So there's no sense that gamers are sort of turned off by something that may seem as preachy to them, you know, sort of preaching to them or taking this approach of, I'm going to educate you with this game rather than let you just play.
Right. And, you know, I think some attitudes are changing. I would say that would have been very true a decade ago, even 5 years ago. But positive impact media and positive impact games are much more mainstream now, especially with the thriving indie community. And so I think in general, you know, our students are more willing to experience something new, and they're definitely discerning. They're definitely sometimes a little bit cagey when they come in, like, oh, what is this thing? But, you know, we have swayed many minds. Also, we've swayed a few that have thought, oh, my God, this is totally offensive, right? You're this incredibly important topic, and you've turned it into a game. Are you crazy?
Mm-hmm.
But we've also turned minds there that this is something we handled it well. We handled it tastefully, and it does allow for information to be learned and a conversation to be had. So,
was that something that you were concerned about?
Oh, yeah. When I was first approached to do a game, I'm like, no. You're crazy. This is such a wickedly hard problem, and games are so hard to make to begin with. But I was persuaded that we should give it a try, because that's what we do here. You know, we experiment, we explore with games. And, you know, I think at this point, I think it's a success, but like I said, it's a work in progress.
The gaming industry and gaming culture in general has really struggled with issues of misogyny. I mean, there's even been coordinated harassment of female developers that we've seen in recent years.
Yep.
Do you see that culture changing at all?
Do I see that culture changing? Instead of trying to make a prognostication of how the future might be, what I would say is, the efforts that we're doing now, like with Make a Change and other games that are out there, are about educating. They're about opening minds and changing opinions and bringing communities together to say this is not okay. So I think that's where we have to start. I mean, otherwise we lose hope, right?
Mm-hmm. So when you look at a game like Change the Game, which is what we're talking about here, this game that addresses issues of sexual assault and harassment on campus and is available for students at Champlain College to play and to learn about, when you see how that could work, you've said you've heard stories of people saying, actually, maybe I do need to get some resources. What would success look like for you in terms of the approach that Champlain College takes, including this game, on combating sexual assault?
Well, success to me is, first of all, Make a Change isn't a silver bullet, right? It's a piece of the puzzle. Not everyone's going to want to play a game, but it is another piece that helps us get through to more people, and that we embrace as a community that this is an issue and that we as a community want to change it. I mean, the college can make all the rules of the world. We can become stricter in how people interact. But, you know, the long run, we have to engage as a community. I think one of the things games allow us to do, because the brain interprets games as an active engagement. In other words, it's like a real thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
It sticks longer. It feels more real, and it gives us a deeper perspective sometimes than something that is just passive. And that can be a real a change in the community that can present, I think, a more robust opportunity to change minds. And if we, you know, make this a community engagement, then we're really, you know, talking to everyone that we want to make a change.
Amanda Crispell is Assistant Dean for Game Development at Champlain College and a faculty advisor for the Women in Technology Club and the Emergent Media Center. Thanks for talking to us about Change the Game.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And that does it for today. Tomorrow, you might have been paying attention to other news, but on Election Day last week, Entergy announced plans to sell the shuttered Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant. Tomorrow, we'll talk about the sale and what it means for the plant, the cleanup, and the area surrounding it. Send your questions and comments to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.